session number 10398, Reel 4.
This is Pomeroy, Reel 4. So you were telling me about the other non-Hook Balahap guerrilla movements against the Japanese. Can you tell me more about them?
I will first tell you about those guerrilla forces that were friendly to the Hook Balahap. The most friendly is the Free Philippines. It's not a guerrilla force in the sense that it operated militarily against the Japanese, but this Free Philippines is a group of people who are intellectuals, and they use their talents in fighting the Japanese by giving us monetary contributions and also doing intelligence work for us. As I was telling you about I.P. Solyongo, he was a member of the Free Philippines. He gave me news through the radio, shortwave. That's the way they helped us. They also gave us money from time to time. Another guerrilla organization close to us, the Anderson guerrillas.
Anderson.
The head is an American, Anderson. His name is Anderson. He was very friendly towards us and also gave us monetary help, also information.
He wasn't an official American? Was he connected with the American government?
Yes. No, not connected. He is one of General MacArthur's men who was left in the Philippines. And he set up a guerrilla force, which he called Anderson's Guerrillas. But they were very friendly with us. And they gave us money from time to time. Big sums of money, you know. Another group that is very friendly to us is the Blue Eagle. Blue Eagle guerrillas, which is led by Danding Alabastro. That's his name. We met him after the war. He was a very nice fellow. This cooperated with the Hook Balahap, and they have really a guerrilla, military guerrilla force. Now, the ones which were hostile to us, as I remember, is the Ramsey guerrillas and the Yusafe guerrillas.
So, Ramsey was the name of an American who was anti-communist.
Yes, yes. Also, this Yusafe, very rapidly anti-communist.
You also mentioned the collaborators with the Japanese. Can you tell me something about those people? Did they form a significant part of the Philippine population?
Well, I would say the collaborators would be about 3 or 4% of the Filipino people. The great majority of the Filipino people were against the Japanese. The collaborators are those who form the core of the puppet government in the Philippines. Jose Laurel became the president of the Philippines at that time, and he collaborated with the Japanese in his belief that somebody has to hold the fort. Otherwise, the Japanese will themselves rule the Philippines. So he thought that it would be easier for the Filipino people to have a Filipino president who could tell the Japanese where their limits are. You know, that's how he excused himself. But the collaborators came mostly from businessmen, you know, Filipino businessmen, intellectuals. And in the provinces, there is a core of collaborators whom they got from the native population who could lead them into the villages and into the towns and who would identify who are guerrillas, you know, that sort of work they did. And in fact, the Hook Balahap killed many of these people who are collaborators because they were able to single out who are the collaborators in the towns. And whenever it was possible, they killed the collaborators.
Would people collaborate for monetary advantage?
Some of them would, because Some of them earn their living that way. Some of them are just too afraid of the Japanese. But I feel sure that their hearts are not with the Japanese.
Would any people collaborate because they believed what the Japanese said about the Japanese Asian co-prosperity sphere?
Some of them would, but that would be a very, very tiny minority. Yes, there were such people who believed that the Japanese would be redeeming us from the hands of the Americans. But that's a very tiny minority. The great majority of collaborators did their job because they have to survive. And another reason is they're afraid of the Japanese. They're afraid for their families because they cannot move around like we can. The guerrillas are very mobile. I was not afraid to go anywhere and leave my family. But these people are so afraid that if they left their work, their positions, the Japanese would get to their families.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you talking about your editorial work with the newspaper. Can you pick up the narrative from there, please?
Yes. Well, the Communist Party of the Philippines had two kinds of newspaper. The Katubusan, or Redemption, is meant for the civilian population. But we had another newspaper called, at first it was called Mandirigma. Mandirigma means soldier. At the first stages of our guerrilla struggle, it was called Mandirigma. Later on, it was changed to Hukbalahap. And this was published by the military section of our party. While Katubusan is published by the civilian section of the party. In other words, Katubusan is distributed to different regions where the party is strong, while Mandirigma is distributed among people whom we want to recruit to become part of our guerrilla force. See, that's the difference. And these two newspapers existed throughout the whole war until 1945.
Did you continue with your work, your editorial work with Katubusan?
Yes, for 2 years, and then there was a change in the structure of our party. You see, we have developed very fast. It was it's a growing movement, and eventually I became a member of a more important body called Senolubu. I was a member of the Central Luzon Bureau at first, as the editor of Katubusan. Central Luzon Bureau. The Central Luzon Bureau is the regional organ of the Communist Party in Central Luzon. That's why it's called Central Luzon Bureau. But it expanded to the north. I mean, our forces and our masses expanded to the north, covering Cagayan and Isabela. These are the northern regions of the Philippines. So the CLB, or Central Luzon Bureau, became the Senolubu, or Central Northern Luzon Bureau. And I was assigned as the chairperson of the education department of the Senolubu, or Central Northern Luzon Bureau. So my work was not only as the editor of Katubusan, but also my work was educational. For instance, to organize schools and to organize a propaganda division and to add to it a cultural division. It's a bigger work. And when the Senolubu was being formed, I'll tell you an incident that happened when the first meeting of Senolubu took place in a village in Nueva Ecija called San Juan. I remember it distinctly. We were a group of about 16 you know. And the general secretary of the party was there, Vicente Lava was there. Mateo del Castillo, the political commissar, was there. Luis Taruc was there. Castro Alejandrino, all the top people, our top people were there. But we were 16 because it is not only the top leaders, but also those who will form Sinulubo were there. Now, while we were having our lunch, our lookout, we have a lookout who sees whether we are safe, you know, immediately told us that he saw about 6 canoes or boats of Japanese coming towards San Juan. We could not see them yet, but he already knew because of the intelligence network we had there. And she said, you've got to evacuate this place. I don't know how, we don't know whether they learned about us or it is just a routine business of the Japanese to go to villages, you see. But immediately, everybody got up. We did not even finish our lunch. But our general secretary said, 2 of you must stay and, you know, clean up this mess here because we were eating. And I volunteered to stay, you know, and the daughter of Comrade Castillo volunteered to stay because we had to clean up and put away all the things we use for eating because it will look strange that, you know, there were so many plates and so many utensils used in for food. So the others left. They went to the forest. The 2 of us, a younger girl with me, we cleaned up the dining room as fast as we can, wash the dishes. They're not really very clean, but just clean them so that it looked as though nobody was eating there. Then I had the feeling that this house is in great danger. So we went to the next house. The fact that we can go to any house in that village shows the prestige of our party in that village. We went to the next house, and the woman there immediately knew that we were in great danger. So she told us to change our clothes so we will look like natives of the village. Because, you know, at that time, a woman who comes from the city dresses differently than the woman who comes from the village. So we changed our clothes. And I had long hair, and she, you know, she put my hair in a bun here so I look like a village woman. But it is very hard to camouflage my companion because she's a mestiza. Mestiza is half white, half Filipino. Because her father is Mateo del Castillo, who looks like a Spaniard. It is hard to disguise her because she has blue eyes, she has light hair, and she has a salient nose, you know. And she looks like a Westerner. Well, the woman of the house says, you better lie down and pretend you have measles. So just so that she will not be recognized. Because it's Japanese. Go into every house. When they raid a village, they go into every house with their bayonets, you know, and they stick this the bayonet in every place which they think guerrillas would be hiding. And then I was in the kitchen, and the woman gave me work to do, like shelling the peas and peeling camotes. Camotes are yams, you know, so that I will look as though I'm her niece or her daughter. And the other girl had to lie down and pretend she has measles. Now, what I found in this experience, when the Japanese came, they came to all the houses. They came to that house where we had our meeting and we had lunch. So they were coming to this house. You know, one of the women, the oldest woman in the house, had presence of mind. You know, she has a grandson who is about 4 or 5 years old, and he was covered with itches. His face, every part of his body, covered with itches because of malnourishment. You know what she did? She got this child, she went down to the doorstep, and she put this child on her lap. And when the Japanese came to our door, to the door of the house where I was, when he saw this child, itches all over his face, you know, and his hands, he was taken aback. He felt dirty. This house must be dirty. He did not come into the house at all. He missed that house where I and the other girl were, you know. And so we were not caught because if he came to our house and saw this mestiza, this girl who looks Western, we might have been taken to jail, you know. But this presence of mind of this old lady was so wonderful. She saved us. And so this, we were spared. And so when we had our reunion with our comrades, they were telling me that they had made a mistake. They should not have allowed me to stay there, because I was going to hold a very important position. And then why did we should just have let Nelly stay there? I mean, the daughter of. So,
you.
That was.
You said that you described how the Japanese would use bayonets for their searches, mm-hmm. but when you saw the Japanese in places like Manila and so on, how would they be behaving towards the local people in everyday life?
Oh, they behave differently in Manila. Because I will tell you an episode in Manila where I almost came to in contact with the Japanese. In one of these stories I told you, when I was working in Manila with the United Front Department, and I was the editor of the United Front Bulletin, I was going from my house, which was in Tondo. I was going to Pasay, which is a town in the suburbs of Manila. And I was carrying a bundle of United Front Bulletin on my arm, about 500 copies. And I was going to give this to the Pasay branch of our party. I was in a rig, you know, this rig with the horse. That's the only means of transportation at that time. And I was sitting near the driver, and we were driving into the most and the busiest section of the city, which is, if I remember right, this is Rizal Avenue. This is a broad street, and there were Japanese everywhere. You see them everywhere, Japanese soldiers. And I was in this rig, and something happened to the horse. The horse tripped, and you know, I fell out of the rig. So did the driver, and all these copies of United Front Bulletin scattered on the floor. You know, and my God, I thought, oh God, this is the end for me, because there were Japanese soldiers, and the Japanese soldiers ran towards me. And then I thought, oh my God, now I'll be in Fort Santiago. But the Japanese, the two Japanese, came and picked up all these papers and gave them back to me, not looking at what is in it. And I said, arigato. That's the only Japanese. Arigato tamadachi. Arigato means thank you. And tamadachi means friend. He says, they were very nice to me. My God, I thought that was a close shave. Maybe they don't even know how to read Filipino. They wouldn't even understand what was in. But it's this fear that I'm doing something illegal, you know.
So the Japanese in Manila wouldn't behave in a way to antagonize the Manila population.
No, that is, I discovered that was, they were rather civil to the average Filipino. But in the provinces, they're brutal. They were savages in the countryside, you know, because what? They know the guerrillas would be there. In Manila, there might be guerrillas, but they don't know where they are. You know, we had guerrilla soldiers in Manila too, but you know, it's very difficult to find out in Manila. But in the provinces, we could be concentrated in certain places.
Mm-hmm. So in Manila, would the guerrillas assassinate Japanese soldiers attack Japanese soldiers?
Yeah, what did we call this? Death squads. We had liquidation squads. We had liquidation squads. And we know some of these people who were the heads of the liquidation squads.
But the Japanese in Manila were not as tense and anxious about the guerrillas in the city as they were in the countryside.
Yes. Because activities by guerrillas in Manila was not too obvious. They had to act in a very circumspect way, because they did not want to put in danger the lives of people and the places where they stayed. It's very difficult to work in Manila as guerrillas. So the movements of our liquidation squads was not frequent. It's not obvious. In fact, they went more for the collaborators rather than the Japanese themselves. But in the provinces, they were very active. They ambushed the Japanese forces in the highways, you know.
In the countryside, would the guerrillas be administering the government in the countryside? Would they be providing the government in areas in the countryside rather than the Japanese providing the government?
Not in every part of the countryside, but there are regions, villages or towns where we had the complete respect and trust of the people. For instance, we had this institution we called BUDC. BUDC means Barrio United Defense Corps. The BUDC operates in villages and towns where party influence is very strong, where the people accept the leadership of the Communist Party. So the government in the villages would be in the hands of communists. They might not all be communists, but usually the what you call teniente del barrio, or the barrio lieutenant, village lieutenant, is usually a party member.
Tenente.
Teniente del barrio. That's a Filipino word for barrio or village lieutenant. Barrio is a village. The word barrio means village. So, in fact, the reason why I could go around, you know, to different villages, it's because of the existence of the BUDC, the Barrio United Defense Corps. I can go into the house of any of these villages and take refuge because of the existence of the BUDC.
But would the guerrillas be organizing such government functions as education, health centers, and so on in the countryside during the war?
No. We could only, the work of the BUDC is to collaborate with the Hukbalahap in doing guerrilla work and some degree of cultural work. Because during that time, we had a group called NECDA. It means, what's the meaning of NECDA? It is the cultural group of our party, and they stage skits, dramas, you know, singing, and they have dancing, you know, dances. These are done in the villages, and this is the only form of amusement of the villagers, because a troop of ours will come into the village and they will announce to the people through leaflets that a show will be shown on such and such a night, and the village people will, you know, will come in great numbers to watch this. There would be skits, dramas, singing, dancing. Sometimes it lasts through the night until morning. I watched one of these. Pardon?
What was the word you said? Skid?
Skits.
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 Satires.
Skits. And Bill saw one of these performances, and he was fascinated by it. I watched one too. It lasted until 3 o'clock in the morning. The villagers love it because they don't have any form of amusement in the villages, nothing at all.
During the war, did the Hukbalahap inaugurate any kind of land reform in the areas which they controlled, or did they leave the landlords alone?
Well, we did not have anything formal, but what the Hukbalahap did is what you call harvest struggles. In other words, you know, the Japanese come to commandeer all the rice, you know, all the corn in regions like the coconut growing regions. They'll confiscate the coconut, they'll confiscate sugar. But in the places where the Hukbalahap was strong, they were never able to commandeer the rice there. It's because the Hukbalahap waged this so-called harvest struggle. In other words, when the harvest came, they mobilized the people to to thresh the rice. And soldiers are all around these regions where the rice is being threshed. And if the Japanese usually are not aware of this, but if they did come into these regions, the Hukbalhap will fight them. I mean, our squadrons will fight them. There was really no incident where our squadron said to fight the Japanese, because this was kept very quiet. The people cooperated with us, so that rice was harvested, and the people got the rice and shared it with us. You know, so we had free food all the time in those regions, but we also protected the people. Otherwise, the Japanese will go there, get the rice, they'll have nothing. And this was very, very successful.
So the Japanese didn't know the exact date when the rice was ripe?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you tell me about the changes which occurred under Japanese occupation? Did conditions under Japanese occupation tend to get worse as time went on, or did they stay the same?
It became worse and worse. That was why it was very easy for us to recruit guerrillas into our forces, because it came to a stage where people had to mix camotes. You know, camotes are yams. They had to mix camotes with rice because there was not enough rice. Sometimes they had to mix rice with corn because there was not enough rice. And there came a time when rice was so scarce that people turned entirely to camotes, you know, these were grown in the fields of Central Luzon. That was why there is this joke about, there is this institution or agency in the Philippines called ECA. What's the meaning of ECA? I forgot now. Economic Committee Agency. Or economic ECA. This is an agency that collects rice from different regions, brings it to Manila, gives it to the Japanese. And the joke we had in the Philippines, I mean, the joke among us is ECA means eat camotes again. Camotes is this yams, you know. This is easily grown. You find it in every region. These are bulbs, you know. It's like potatoes, but it's sweet.